I'd forgotten. Go ahead, take as long as you need.
Sure.
Well, I asked you to read the excise chapter at Tijon's specifically for one reason. I think it fills in a great deal about Stavrogin. Some critics think that it's not necessary, and that Dostoevsky was right ultimately not to put it into any of the editions of the novel that were published in his lifetime. Others point to the fact that he took it out and tried to rewrite it to satisfy the censors, and that he felt that it was very important, and they feel that it is, as a matter of fact, an important chapter to restore to it. Because of this division of opinion, I've noticed that every translation I've run across puts it in an appendix rather than restoring it. That way you can have it both ways. You can not read it or read it if you wish. But I wanted you to read it, not so much for the long confession letter, if that's what it is, but for the mention in it of the painting of the Golden Age. Right, and I put a, not a link actually, but the image itself on Blackboard if you want to look at it. It's the Claude Lorrain, Acis in Galatea painting that he refers to looks like. And because it's the center of what I want to talk about today. And that is to go a little bit more deeply into questions involving this literary image, I suppose we could call it, that Bakhtin first identified as carnival, and in which he speaks of carnivalization. And I want you to see that this is related to utopia and radicalism at the same time in a very interesting fashion. You remember that Tijon tells Stavrogin that if he publishes his document, that the reaction to it is one that he's not going to like. Stavrogin says, you mean people will hate me for it? And he said, well, some will, but most of them will laugh at you. Now, this is what's going on, actually, in The Possessed. That is, there is a flipping sort of motion between horror, on the one hand, and laughter. So that the events that occur, which seem so shocking, and we see a number of them, are all treated with a rather acerbic irony, as we get in the meeting of our people, where the socialists who are going to liberate mankind from all kinds of rules and authorities can't agree with one another about much of anything. So we see this flip from the threatening, from the dangerous, from the horrible, even murder and all of this, and it looked at it another way, it becomes grotesque and comic. Now it happens that Bakhtin, having written on this extensively, and by the way, I put the 11 or so pages from the Dostoevsky book on Blackboard, so if you want to read the whole thing, there it is. But I'll read a little bit from the opening pages of this section. Now he explains that this is not this notion of carnival is not an analytic abstract form that he's using, but rather he says it's a sense of the world. It's a unified sense of the world. It's more a form, actually. It cannot, he says, be translated in any full or adequate way into a verbal language, much less into a language of abstract concepts. But it is amenable to a certain transposition into a language of artistic images that has something in common with its concretely sensuous nature. That is, it can be transposed into the language of literature. And he goes on to talk about what Carnival is, and he gives a bit of a history of it, tracing it from its origins in the Middle Ages and to its final, well, I suppose you could say decline, but nevertheless persisting presence in the modern world, where it has much less importance than it had before, where it has become totally formalized, and where it is roped off into special occasions like Mardi Gras that are more about entertainment than the rather more profound meaning it had in its earlier period of existence. All right, so he says, Carnival is a pageant without footlights and without a division into performers and spectators. And what we see in each of these big scenes in which people are gathered for an occasion, whether it be a name day at Virginsky's, and Virginsky, of course, you realize the Russian word for virgin is not virgin, so Virginsky's name says something about his character as well. But in any case, the gathering at Virginsky's is in a carnivalesque atmosphere, as a matter of fact. The Sunday evening gathering at the home of the hostess, in this case, the lady who suspects that her son, Stavrogin, has been up to something with Maria, that too turns into a carnivalesque sort of scene, and I'll explain how in a minute. And the carnivalesque scene comes to a climax with, of course, the slap that's delivered at the end. Once you see what Bakhtin's patterns are that he identifies by analyzing the carnival phenomenon, you'll see why this slap fits in so perfectly to the entire ritual that is carnival. All right, so carnival, he says, has no division into performers and spectators. That was a carnivalesque moment right there. In carnival, everyone is an active participant. Everyone communes in the carnival act. Carnival is not contemplated, and strictly speaking, not even performed. Its participants live in it. They live by its laws as long as those laws are in effect. That is, they live a carnivalistic life. Because carnivalistic life is life drawn out of its usual rut. And so in each of these three scenes, so first of all, the Sunday evening gathering, and then the name day party, and then finally the fete. In each of these, something happens that is not expected or not planned for. Because you can't really plan carnival, even though it has all of the aspects of ritual and therefore has regular events and regular characteristics. So he says, because it is life drawn out of its usual rut, it is to some extent life turned inside out, the reverse side of the world. The laws, prohibitions, and restrictions that determine the structure and order of ordinary, that is, non-carnival life, that's fun to think of carnival as being for a moment the defining of life, and everything else is non-carnival life, ordinary life. These laws, prohibitions, and restrictions are suspended. Right, during carnival. What is suspended, first of all, now listen carefully, is hierarchical structure and all the forms of terror, reverence, piety, and etiquette connected with it. That is, everything resulting from socio-hierarchical inequality or any other form of inequality among people, including age. All distance between people is suspended, and a special carnival category goes into effect, free and familiar contact among people. Now, there's not time today and probably not time this semester for me to explain to you in detail how this fits in with the Fourierist utopia of harmony. But I'll just mention a couple of aspects of it before I go back, and I hope I don't confuse you here, to talk about these characteristics of carnival as Bakhtin defines them. So for Fourier, God exists, but he is only a prime principle. You know, sort of, not even an Aristotelian unmoved mover, actually. He's just the principle of the existence of material, the material world. So God is the first principle, but that's it. Then there is matter. But matter doesn't do anything, because then there has to be some sort of force or relationship that causes matter to be more than inert material, but to become something. And the principal force that does this is man. Man, then, is created by God in order to make the world into something, ultimately. So if the world becomes something, if the world has a future, it's because man exists. And this Fourier's system is extraordinarily complicated. It's all organically unified by all sorts of things. That is to say, the notes of the scale also indicate personalities or large aspects of personalities. Even fruit and vegetables are part of all of this. It's extraordinarily well set out, if you believe that these relationships are there and not just wild imaginings of the author, which they usually seem to be. But when you look at it all together, you see at least a complete system. All right, skipping over a lot, I simply point out that for Fourier, civilization is the enemy. Now, this is very Rousseauistic, right? Civilization is the enemy, exactly in the terms that Bakhtin speaks of. All the forms of terror, reverence, piety, and etiquette, all the laws and rules imposed on us by civilization. And by the way, Fourier is surely at the origin of some of this business of the distinction between culture and civilization that you get in a later writer such as Oswald Spengler, author of The Decline of the West, which is published in right after the First World War. And there he says there is first culture, and then as culture begins to harden and ossify, it becomes civilization. So the Greeks are culture and the Romans are civilization and so on. Well, all right. But for Fourier, civilization is the enemy because it places constraints on what is natural. What does it do? Well, it ultimately frustrates the natural in various ways. You might say that one of Fourier's slogans could have been, not let the market decide, but let the natural decide. In other words, leave things alone and they'll work themselves out, because he's got this enormous scheme that describes everything, including the stars, by the way. Now, the planets and stars are all linked into this extraordinary, mathematically precise system. Well, what is it that the natural decides? What is civilization the enemy of? The enemy of desire and natural passions. So if human beings have a right, they have a right to fulfill their passions, their desires. That's a natural right, according to Fourier. And he goes pretty far with this, even to sexual perversity. It's very interesting how all this works out. So instead of a minimum wage or a minimum income, although he does provide for that in his system, he postulates the necessity for a minimum sexual pleasure. In other words, everybody ought to get something. And a minimum of social engagement. This is a natural right, according to Fourier, right? So, no frustration of desire. And there are all kinds of different desires, you see. Some people are just sort of straight, and some people are a bit perverse, but that's all right. And there will be in this society people who are sort of angels and who will help you fulfill your perverse desires. Now, they won't do this very long, but you know, you have a right to have this satisfied. There will be people, for example, there are all kinds of ways that you can desire things. There will be some people who want to flit from one thing to another, who have to have a constant variety in what they do, and he calls that butterflying, like a butterfly, you know. None of this will work, of course, without an organization. And here's the key, you see. So the phalanstery, the organization, then is very intricately designed to provide a structure so that all this can happen. So, in very, very brief order, that is part of the Fourierist system. And you can see how, if you don't have the structure in place, what might you get? You'll get a Stavrokin, or you'll get a Peter Verkhovensky, or you'll get a Kirillov. You know, you'll get these people. Because what you see, ultimately, is without this social cooperative order. And by the way, Fourier was practically the inventor of the idea of the economic cooperative, incidentally. If he made a contribution anywhere that we can see in subsequent Western civilization, it's the notion of the economic cooperative. All right, but without a means of ensuring that cooperation and keeping it going, and keeping it from going off the rails. In other words, it's supposed to work according to a natural balance because the passions are all naturally balanced. And if you follow your natural inclinations, then all of this will work in harmony together. One thing will balance the other. But if you don't have some kind of organization to do it, then it won't work. Then what you're left with is the notion that the will and desire and whatever you want to do is fine. And it doesn't matter what happens to other people. Now, the Fourierist model is a kind of concern for others and charity towards others and care for others and all that. But without a way of structuring it, you get a kind of monstrosity, in an assertion of free will that ultimately rejects any notion of good and evil. You get Stavrogin, in effect. As I mentioned earlier, Dostoevsky was thoroughly familiar with the Fourierist system, which he became acquainted with in his early career. And so he's showing the consequences of at least one form of this utopian socialism, the utopia of desire. Now, this goes back to a very old image, the myth of the Golden Age, where there is no civilization, there are no laws, there are no rules, where everyone lives at peace with everyone else, and where everything is in harmony. And this is that painting of Acis and Galatea by Claude Lorrain that is referred to in the document read in the chapter at Tihon. Stavrogin is totally free, but then, if you're totally free, what meaning do things have? And so he has to experience things that give him a rush And he's discovered the only way to experience these things is through suffering or through somehow countering the usual strictures of society and expectations. In other words, he is without an institution that can balance his various insatiable passions. And he gets bored easily, so he has to go on to do something else. He's a butterfly in the Fourierist meaning of that term. Now, Stavrogin is Peter's better half. This is from the text. And Stavrogin calls Peter his clown. And I'm going to use this little comparison to point to something else, because we could say that the Faust motif, Goethe's Faust, by the way, not so much Marlowe's Faustus, the notion here is that Stavrogin is a Lucifer, a rebel who revolts against any other will but his own. So if God exists, then God's will is the one that will prevail, not mine. So he's Lucifer. Well, what does this make Peter? Peter is Mephistopheles. Mephisto, the man who goes about then trying to capture other people's souls. But Peter is also a clown. And of course, there is in the whole history of demonology this image of Mephistopheles as the shabby devil, you know, the quasi-comical devil. Lucifer is, especially in Milton, but Lucifer didn't invent this figure, Lucifer is the brilliant one, the shining one, the brightest of all the angels. So in this confluence, then we get utopia on the one hand, the demons, the title of the book, and carnival, all wrapped into one amazing package. And how does that work? Well, let's go back to Bakhtin now. So he says, carnival then is the place for working out in a concretely sensuous, half-real and half-play-acted form. All right, so it's important to notice that in carnival, there is the half-real. Of course, it's play-acted, but there is something serious about it. It's the act working out a new mode of interrelationship between individuals. So you may begin to see where I'm going here. That is, the institution that Fourier would create had already been provided, in fact, by the invention of carnival. So this new mode of interrelationship is counterposed to the all-powerful socio-hierarchical relationships of non-carnival life. The behavior, gesture, and discourse of a person are freed from the authority of all hierarchical positions, social estate, rank, age, property, defining them totally in non-carnival life, and thus from the vantage point of non-carnival life become eccentric and inappropriate. And we see this throughout the devils, don't we? Where this eruption of the ridiculously inappropriate behavior of characters. See, we're full of the carnivalesque. We can't escape it. So, eccentricity is a special category of the carnival sense of the world, organically connected with the category of familiar contact. It permits the latent sides of human nature to reveal and express themselves. The latent sides. The sides we have repressed or hidden, the secret sides that we don't want to acknowledge. And so he says there is linked with this familiarity familiarization, he says, is a third category. He calls it carnivalistic mésalliance, mismatches. A free and familiar attitude spreads over everything, over all values, thoughts, phenomena, and things. All things that were once self-enclosed, disunified, distanced from one another, he says, are drawn into carnivalistic contacts and combination. So carnival brings together, unifies, weds, and combines the sacred with the profane, the lofty with the low, the great with the insignificant, the wise with the stupid. And he says connected with this is a fourth category, profanation. Carnivalistic blasphemies. And there's that carnivalistic moment when the icon, the glass or the icon is broken and somebody steals some of the precious gems from the icon. But then the carnivalistic side of it is when somebody puts a mouse inside the frame. Right, so it's a blasphemy. A whole system of carnivalistic debasings and bringings down to earth, carnivalistic obscenities linked with the reproductive power of the earth and the body, carnivalistic parodies on sacred texts and sayings, etc. He says these are not abstract thoughts about equality and freedom, the interrelatedness of all things, or unity of opposites. No, these are concretely sensuous ritual pageant thoughts experienced and played out in the form of life itself, thoughts that had coalesced and survived for thousands of years among the broadest masses of European mankind. And so this is then a part of human history and human nature that once during the year we're reminded of. It's brought up from the depths, it's brought up from the hidden side of our life, and it's made explicit, and we act it out. So how is it half pretend and half real? It's half pretend because, of course, we're not going to go around acting this way the rest of the year. And it's licensed, that is, we are allowed to act silly and do ridiculous and outrageous things, and we won't be punished for it. You might say we're allowed to get it out of our system, but it is real. It is a part of us and a part of what we are. And it's not a part of the sinful side of us. It's a part of the earthy side of us. Carnival is then a challenge to the abstract and the rule-driven and the over-rational. Right, so let us look now a little bit at how this is played out in these scenes. So I want to start by, wait a minute. I have to tell you about one other thing, though, before we do this. There is the figure of the clown. I mentioned this before. The primary carnivalistic act, according to Bakhtin, is the mock crowning and subsequent decrowning of the carnival king. This ritual, he says, is encountered in one form or another in all festivities of the carnival type. Well, by the way, carnival is not a specifically Christian phenomenon, although farewell to meat, that's what carnival is. It's carnevale, farewell to meat, comes just before Lent. So it's your last fling at fulfilling your desires before you give everything up in Lent, you see. And then that's followed by the celebration of the resurrection of the body. But now this is the transformed body, and without the contrast between carnival and Lent, the transformation cannot take place. Right? That's the Christian version of it. But we find it, for example, in ancient Rome, in the Saturnalia. And the Saturnalia refers back to the time of the god Saturn, when men and gods met on a daily basis and even dined together. You see, so this theme of equality, or at least consorting with the gods, goes back to the Golden Age. And then if you've read your Hesiod, you know that at some point there is a decline in the quality of human beings, a kind of fall, if you were, until we each reach the age of iron. And at that point, we no longer commune with the gods or dine with them in any direct way. So that's Saturnalia. And it's a Golden Age myth. And there was a Saturnalia festival that was very carnivalistic. All right. So the Festival of Fools, which included in the Middle Ages, by the way, a mass of the fools, a kind of parodic mass. It's the mass of the, well, that sounds funny in English, doesn't it? The mass of the ass, where the fool comes in, instead of the priest, riding a donkey. And of course, it's a parody of the entry of Christ into Jerusalem, remember, on Palm Sunday, and so on. So this is the blasphemy part of it. Of course, once it's ritualized, it's no longer a blasphemy, but in a way, a way of looking at the other side of things, at the low side of things. Well, all right. The instead of high-ranking officials, then you have the ritual act of the crowning of a fool as king. But at the end of Carnival, he can't be left as the highest official in the land. He has to be decrowned. And in this decrowning, Bakhtin says, lies the very core of the Carnival sense of the world, the pathos of shifts and changes, of death and renewal. Carnival is the festival of all annihilating and all renewing time. And so it's then a kind of playing out of the course of time, how things grow and mature and then decay and die. And so the decrowning ritual is both a structure and an anti-structure. And so all of the aspects of the actual ceremony, the symbols of authority, then become ambivalent and turn into stage props in this ritual. And then finally, their symbolic meaning becomes too leveled. So instead of taking authority literally, as we usually do, or as Bakhtin might say, monophonically, we take it in multiple senses. We begin to see the rich dimensions that inform everything we do. But the decrowning then completes the coronation and is inseparable from it. So the crown is not only removed from the king, but he is beaten and ridiculed. In other words, you see in this a kind of earthy version of a crucifixion. And so it repeats the pattern of Lent and Easter. There is the Carnival King now who'll be decrowned, uncrowned, and beaten to remind them that he is a mortal man and only flesh. And don't think that this elevation to which you've been treated is really you. It only lasts for a short while. So we find this all over the place, as Bakhtin points out. Uh-huh.
Did the Jews have a sense of the Passover being a kind of carnival at all?
Passover? Passover is more future-oriented. It's a rehearsal of the past, the promised land of the past, and the the chosen people brought into the new land of milk and honey on the one hand, and at the same time, the projection into the future of the promise of a Messiah and of a new coming of the kingdom, you see. So, yes and no, in a way.
I'm just thinking that Christ being brought in on the donkey is kind of the first part, and then crucifixion would be the second part.
Right, yeah.
But that would be the end of carnal.
But that's the Christian rendering of the Christian edition of Passover, in a way, except that, see, the shock, you remember St. Paul says that that Christ was a scandal to the Jews, a folly to the Greeks and scandal to the Jews. Well, folly to the Greeks because they're very rational, the Greeks are, or at least we like to think they were. They had their irrational side too. There's a book by E.R. Dodds called The Greeks and the Irrational. That's a very well-known book. But a scandal to the Jews because Messiah is supposed to be a great leader and not someone who'd be crucified. So the whole Christian story then is itself almost a carnivalistic rendering of Passover. But I don't want to get very far afield from this because we have work to do here. All right. I was going to read you something from Vyacheslav Ivanov's, but maybe I better let you go on ahead.
Go ahead and develop, and I'll put me off until next time.
Okay. Let's look at what happens now in that first episode at Madame Stavrogin's. So first of all, there is this carnival business begins at church. Mrs. Stavrogin comes out of church, and whom does she see?
Maria.
And what happens? What is Maria doing?
Maria, she goes up to the altar, prostrates herself, and then Mrs. Stavrogin approaches to receive, I guess, and then Maria kneels in front of her.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like the bringing up of the cruet and the water. You know, that's what Mrs. Stavrogin is doing. It's the equivalent in the Orthodox liturgy. All right, so she goes up. And then after that, as they're leaving church, what happens? Paging through your books, huh? I should have put that on the put that on the quiz.
What page number is it?
This is Maria.
I remember the incident.
Asked to kiss her hand, right?
Yes, she asked to kiss her hand.
And she's all like dressed up with a rose and everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Why does that happen, by the way? We don't know when we're reading this, do we? We don't understand what's going on.
Is her mother-in-law?
Yeah, because she, and already Mrs. Stavrogin has begun to suspect something, which is why she puts her in her carriage and takes her to her house. But look at it from a carnivalistic point of view. What do you get? You get this lowly, mad woman who is suddenly associating with this wealthy, powerful woman. Right? Already, once we're tuned into the carnival pattern, we begin to recognize this as the beginning of something. What goes on in the course of the evening? Whom are they all talking about? Oh, first of all, what was supposed to happen in this gathering that Stepan Verkhovensky is so concerned about? Yeah, his engagement to Dasha is supposed to be announced. It never happens, does it? Now, there are two women in addition to Maria, both in love with Stavrogin. In fact, everybody seems to be in love with Stavrogin.
That's true.
He has this strange power of attraction. It's almost uncanny, and it seems to flow from something he has, this eerie character about him that draws people to him. And if we think of the Luciferian parallel again, we see what it is. There is something demonic about him that people don't recognize. They turn it into something else. Well, all right, so there's all this talk about Stavrogin. Now, who comes in at this point? Well, before him.
Captain.
Yeah, first Vyatkin comes in. And he is all dressed up, isn't he? Mm-hmm. Oddly enough. Right. And he comes in, of course, his sister is there. Right. And he makes a fool of himself. Now, he is the other indication that we're in a carnivalistic mode here, you see? He's the clown figure. But this is where Dostoevsky does something really interesting. The real clown who comes in is
Peter.
Who goes around being very polite, playing out his role. But we know he's play acting. And we expect him to be uncrowned in this carnivalistic scene, don't we? But he isn't. Who shows up instead? Now remember the Mephistopheles-Lucifer parallel here. So now who shows up? Nikolai shows up, yeah. Or Nicholas, if you want to follow the Magoshak rendering of it. All right, so Nikolai shows up, and what happens?
He gets punched in the face.
Huh?
He gets punched in the face.
Well, before that. Before that,
Lavar asks if he's married to
him. Yes. And what is his answer?
No.
Well,
he's kind of to kiss her hand.
Yeah. Yeah, he kisses her hand. Now, you see, something interesting going on here. All right, so then he's hitting with a fist, really. It's called a slap, but since it's with a clenched fist, I think we have to say that it's a bit more than that. This is the uncrowning. Now think about it. You see, he's the crown prince when he comes in. Everybody loves him. Everybody looks at him. He's the center of this scene. He's the focus of it. Peter is not really the fool who gets crowned. And Stavrogin, we don't want to think of as a fool because he doesn't act like a fool. And so at this point, we see that this is demonically carnivalesque. It's a combination of the demonic and the carnival. And what we get then is Stavrogin as Lucifer. And Lucifer gets his comeuppance. Because what is so, is later remarked on by Mrs. Van Lemke, who explains why Stavrogin doesn't challenge him to a duel or even strike back, but simply stands there. And what's the explanation for that?
He was a former serf.
Yes. And he's not on Stavrogin's social level, so he couldn't possibly treat him as an equal, Mrs. Van Lemke says. And everybody says, well, of course. That explains it all, doesn't it? Oh, she's brilliant. You know, and they all praise her for her perspicacity. But what do we see? What does Lucifer do when he's cast out of heaven? Or what is Milton's Lucifer, anyway, if that's your source for Luciferian behavior? What does he say? What does he do? Yeah, there we are. So he's crowned and uncrowned. But it's a Luciferian variety of the Carnivalesque. Now, fast forward to the name day party. By the way, I know Dostoevsky had read Milton, although it may have been in translation. Can anybody sense a parallel between book two of Paradise Lost and the name day party?
It's like all the demons discussing things.
Yes. What happens in book two of Paradise Lost?
Isn't that where they go through all the different ways that they could proceed or whatever?
Uh-huh.
I mean, there's like war, diplomacy.
Yes. And what does Lucifer do and his sidekick? Who's his sidekick?
Beelzebub.
Beelzebub. Okay.
Oh, they've already decided. They're just letting everyone talk.
That's right. I've often said, if you want to know how to structure and conduct a committee meeting, read Book Two of Paradise Lost. Have the solution already. See, you've got it all figured out. And you let people, you try to come to a conclusion about a good scheme, a good mode of proceeding in committee, and you know what happens. It's always the same. You know, people argue with one another, and everything ends up at a kind of standstill, if not a standoff. So what Satan does in Book Two is just let them wear themselves out by contradicting one another. Now, you know, open war. No, open war? Are you kidding? Look, who wants to be annihilated? No, let's just, God will forget about us, and we can fix this place up, and hell, you know, after a while, you know, the fires will cool down and all of this. So this is exactly what happens. But who is being Beelzebub here?
Peter,
right? And then Stavrogin does what? How does Peter behave in the name day episode?
Is he cutting his nails and stuff?
Yeah, he ignores them. And when he goes outside, when Stavrogin suddenly gets up and leaves because he's bored with it all, Peter rushes out, and what does he say? And this is one of the most extraordinary scenes in the whole novel, in a way. What does Peter say to him?
I love you or something like that.
Yes. I need you. Huh?
What page is that on? So I can underline it.
Oh, let's see. It would be on page... Oh, I don't know. Let's see. Before the Fed... anybody happen to... Oh, it's at Ivan the Crown Prince, isn't it? Yeah. It's page 414. Or so. Oh, no. Is this the... No, it's just before that, sorry. I don't have this particular copy marked because actually it's a library copy and somebody else is like 420. Yeah. My references are all to a different translation, sorry. Stavrogin, you're beautiful. Do you know that you're beautiful? What does Lucifer mean in Latin? The bearer of light, yeah. What is so fine about you is that sometimes you don't know it. And he goes on to say, I love beauty. I'm a nihilist, but I love beauty. Don't nihilists love beauty? The only thing they do not love is idols, but I love an idol. You are my idol. You don't insult anyone and everyone hates you. You look on everyone as your equal and everyone is afraid of you. So these are the inversions of carnival, aren't they? But they're also the inversions of the demonic at the same time. And so these scenes are hilarious on the one hand and shocking on the other. From viewed from a demonic side, we can see a full process of possession taking place. Viewed from the carnivalistic side, we can see how absurd and silly evil is. And so I find, by the way, it's only about 11 pages. If you're really interested in this business of carnival, go online and look under the supplementary readings. It's the last one, I think, under Dostoevsky. I just put it on this afternoon for you, if you'd like to explore this a little further. Now, what happens at the fete? Oh, before that, what happens? We get another odd scene. We had the the police come in, and what do? To poor Stepan Verkhovensky. They take his papers. Yeah. And he says, at one point there's a pun. He says, you need to go to the station, meaning the police station. And he says, no, what I want is my stationery. In any event, again, exactly the same thing happens. He goes down to the police station to ask for his, to protest. And there he meets the gaggle of workers who have been fired and who are from their factory, and they're going out to protest, to demonstrate peacefully and quietly in front of the police station. And of course, Peter comes in, demonically active once more, and he starts working them all up. He's really good at working a crowd. By the way, you notice a very interesting thing that he says, I'm not a socialist. I'm not a socialist. He's an anarchist. He's not a socialist. He's not even really quite a nihilist, although apparently he does believe that you're going to have to destroy all of civilization as we know it and start over. And this, again, comes out of this Fourierist reaction against blaming of civilization as the enemy. Well, at this point, poor Stepan Verkhovensky, who is himself very much a clown figure throughout, he ends up then protesting. And then we see the poor governor, von Lemke, then gets into trouble with Mrs. von Lemke again. And we get this scene, which could turn into a riot or into a slaughter or something terrible. It turns into a scene between a henpecked husband and his wife, who is not going to let anything get in the way of this fete and the prestige, local prestige, that is going to be hers as a result of her staging this event. And, well, just to finish up, what happens at the fete? What doesn't happen, right? What are some of the things that go awry, that go wrong?
Ragamuffins in the back, they keep yelling and messing up.
Yeah, and again, you see this carnivalistic element intruding into this snooty, pretentious, upper-class affair, pretending to be an opening to the new ideas, right? And at the end of it, of course, the whole thing's a disaster. By the way, what does Stepan Verkhovensky do? Oh, there's the fellow who reads the paper before him. What's that about?
Is it Liputin? Or is that like the dirty poem or whatever?
Yeah. Is that carnivalesque or what? You know, totally so. And then there's, what does Stepan Verkhovensky talk about?
Beauty.
Beauty. Yes. Beauty. And he argues that shoes are not better than Pushkin. Now, this is an allusion to an actual article, by the way, a socialist article. In the end, at the end of that, already before that, humiliated once again, Stepan Verkhovensky says at the end of the episode with the filibusters. He says, I am on my new path. And we'll see how that works out next time. But in any case, it is the that fete is the turning point then in the whole carnivalesque world of this novel, because after this, things are no longer carnivalesque. They become very serious indeed. But we'll finish that up next time.